All right. So, hello. My name is Adrian Salma. I'm a program evaluation manager in the Children's Community Mental Health Services and Wraparound Milwaukee. So, for item 2B, I recognize that we have quite a bit on the agenda. So, I'm going to just provide some highlights and then I'll make some time for questions. So some highlights include that in quarter three, we did serve more families than we did in past quarters. So that's exciting to see that despite still being in a pandemic, that we're serving families. On the next page, our average cost of care continues to be pretty cost effective per family. Numbers haven't really changed for those costs between programs. Another thing I want to highlight is in our population health section of the report, in that quarter, we actually had fewer youth in wraparound and reach who went from a home care setting to out of home in that quarter. So it's exciting to see that the number had decreased. That's something that we want to see in wraparound, is that we're meeting kids and families where they're at in the community. Unfortunately, we do still see not as many natural supports on our child and family teams, as you can see with Reach, Wraparound, and CCS, but we believe that this continued lower percentage of natural supports has to do with safety and, the continued emerging variants that we see with COVID even today. Finally, on the outcomes page, the next page, I want to highlight that we continue to see a positive regards from our family satisfaction survey for an overall score of 4.6 out of 5. This survey is given to wraparound and reach families. CCS receives an annual survey, the MISIP survey, which has just concluded, and we hope to have the results by next quarter. So those are the highlights that I wanted to provide for today. Now I'll take any questions or comments you all have.
Adrian, I'd like to ask you a question about the average cost per family.
Mm-hmm.
It's not possible. I'm thinking about some kind of comparative analysis between the average cost per family at BHD in Milwaukee County and other similar places. We obviously can't compare it to private agencies, to the cost of private agencies, because this is a public responsibility. Do you have any sense at all of the value of this compared to costs that would be associated in a different but similar place? Because I have absolutely no idea whether $4,371 is great value for the buck or a waste. That's an extreme way of saying what I want to say. I don't have the right words. You know, I want to be able to assess these numbers within some meaningful way.
I think that's a great point, Rachel. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but if I were to do a comparative analysis, which I could do, I would actually look at, there's two ways we could go about it. So the average costs broken out by program, I would do a comparative analysis between other wraparound programs, because that would be apples to apples for wraparound and reach. Mm-hmm. And then for CCS, other counties there. So
I was going to actually interrupt you. We do have data around like different types of care, like around group home care, residential care, corrections, and hospitalization per month. Rachel, we do provide that data. If that is something you are
interested in. I'm not checking up on you. I want to know. Frankly, as a mental health board member, I'm looking for sources of pride, and I'm suspecting that this is a fabulous figure. But I want to be able to be in settings with people who work in this field and from other places and say, for example, I guess this brings out my competitive nature. You know, in Chicago, it costs them $9,000 to do what our people are doing in Milwaukee County for $4,000 and change. That might have sound like a juvenile example, but I just want to give you the spirit of my question.
Okay. Rachel?
Yeah.
Dr. Schneider here. I think one of the biggest challenges is apples to apples versus apples to orange. The way the program is created and the way, and Brian can probably talk your ear off, the way our program is defined is based on how the state creates the program. So even state to state, there aren't going to be great comparators. So within CCS, I think we could do in-state data. But I think the better question is, these are high-need patients that are going to cost us a lot regardless because they're high-need patients. Mm-hmm. The better question is, if we look at it over time, are we getting better over time based on how our system is put together? That may be the best comparator we have, as opposed to going to look at a broader comparator, because a lot of this is driven based on the patient selection, which we don't have a whole lot of control over. So that's my two cents.
And good morning as well. And Dr. Schneider, I appreciate you saying that, because absolutely correct. The apple-to-apple comparison outside of our community, we'll never be able to get to that type of level of breakdown and comparison just because of a few factors. And one, Dr. Schneider alluded to the way the state has set up our contracting as well as our service system here. But it also has to do with how we partner with our other child welfare and juvenile justice partners and how we utilize a really blended and flexible budget and pool of funds to be able to carry those services out. But what you were alluding to in your overall statement, Rachel, is actually what we take a lot of pride in overall, is that we're able to reduce the cost of services and provide high quality service as well for those dollars. And it has to do with a lot of that structure and as well as how we blend those funds together to do that. But RAP and REACH historically as programs have been built on the idea of better cost for service in your home community, which leads to better outcomes. And we do report that stuff, and we do go in other places and present that information because of that big impact. And we should be proud of that overall with the service delivery. And you have to, you know, really look at what's included and what's paid for in a lot of those different programs where wraparound and then some in reach pay for out-of-home care out of that those costs as well. So it really is something that we take pride in and feel that there's extreme value in what we're able to provide that.
Thank you. I appreciate the conversation. Thank you. Your responses. Thank you.
I'd like to address the discharge outcomes.
Yeah.
Looking at the total of the three programs, appears that there were 170 discharges over the course of seven categories. And out of those seven categories, there were 39 individuals that completed the program and 19 that were transferred within system of care or other programs. So that comes to 34% of the 170. So there were 66% of the 170 individuals that didn't complete a program. They were either went into corrections, their eligibility ended, we lost contact with them, or their services were no longer desired. I don't think those are very effective outcomes.
With the eligibility ending and the loss of contact, I definitely agree with that. Actually, the way we look at services no longer desired is more of a neutral item, because looking at more so client choice, there might be some circumstances where clients aren't happy with services, but some circumstances where clients might just feel like they don't need it anymore at that time in their life. But I do agree with you that
I can flex a bit.
I'll add to that, services no longer desired, Mary. Sometimes we come across situations where maybe a youth wants the services, but parents are no longer interested, or vice versa as well. When kids are over the age of 14, they might not be interested because they feel like they've kind of accomplished everything that they need to, but parents were interested. So we do run across some of those situations as well, and that falls in that category. So it's a pretty broad category.
Yep. That's what I was saying. I can buy it. I understand that group of 40 individuals.
Yeah.
But we're still looking at a large population of individuals that have really poor outcomes.
Yeah, so I would also add, obviously the loss of contact is something absolutely we agree with, and we definitely address and we look at those situations every time they come up. So we have our program managers looking in to making sure that we're tempting everything we possibly can. Are the agencies, you know, reaching out? Are they following up via phone call, letters, stopping by? What type of attempts are they making to make that contact? Eligibility ended. What's tough about that situation, I will just say as well, is they could be doing really well or they could be making progress, but maybe they're no longer Medicaid eligible. And that's the reason why they disenrolled. It doesn't mean that the program wasn't working or the program that they weren't making progress. So that one, I would also just, there are some caveats to that piece because we don't have control over if they are Medicaid eligible or not. And we always give it like an extra month to try to help families get, if they are able to reapply or they do become eligible, we give an extra month to make sure that can happen. So that one is a little tricky because we aren't able to dive, just that discharge reason isn't solely because they weren't making progress or they weren't interested in the program.
Okay.
I have a general question about, we're experiencing declining enrollment. It's like declining enrollment. Is there a reason for that?
Well, I think, and I can jump in and take this. I think what we're seeing in our wraparound enrollment numbers is the decrease in enrollment based on the kids entering in one door of the children's system, meaning that there's a declining number of youth that would normally have been in our wraparound program but are not entering the juvenile justice system in the same way. So it's kind of a hit for us of kids being enrolled in wraparound through a formal channel, and the other side of that is the really growth of CCS services as well. We're seeing a high number of growth within our community-based programs of CCS and REACH, so less kids coming in through those formal systems, and the growth of our community programs is really where we're seeing a lot of that trend happening. And unfortunately or fortunately, I guess depending on how you look at that that wraparound enrollment number, we're doing better things, new things with kids on the front end, and really trying to stop them from going deeper into the court system and or the child welfare system, and serving them differently with different resources there before they end up meeting our wraparound programming overall. So that's the trends that we're seeing.
Yeah, it looks like the Dane County programs also seeing declining enrollment. It just what is the global reason? Is COVID a reason? I understand your point that there's competing programs, CCS and so on. that are, you know, I don't know what the reason is. It looks like it could be environmental and it affects both programs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The good thing about that is that we have, over the last couple of years, really strengthened the communication and partnerships with Dane in having some cross-system conversations, and they will say the same thing, that declining numbers overall in their Children Come First, which is wraparounds comparable to Dane County, but also the increase in other system supports that are using. So we're seeing similar things there, and we certainly are at the table with the state partners as well as Madison to kind of talk through those contractual fiscal and enrollment pieces continually. And we are actually looking to set another one up here in the next couple of weeks to discuss. So we're certainly working on it together.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Courtney, are you on the line?
Yes, hi. Sorry, I didn't know if I should just jump in or if there was a process. This is my first time attending these meetings. I apologize. Hi, everyone. Courtney Geiger. I'm going to do a brief presentation on a project that I am the project director on through a grant that we received. So I'm just going to share my screen. Can everyone see this okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. All right. So thank you for your time. Again, my name is Courtney Geiger, and I am the project director of MAT Behind the Walls. I am new to Milwaukee County BHD, and I am under the Community Access to Recovery Services. So today I'm going to be discussing the purpose of the program, some grant information, eligibility for folks to participate in the program, goals of the project, some benefits of the program, demographics of participants, and then at the end, if there are any questions, I'll answer them then. So just some background information, why we applied for the grant, why it's important that we have this grant and what it's doing for us. I'm assuming most people here are pretty well aware that nationally we are experiencing an opioid epidemic. But just for some context, I did read the Journal Sentinel this morning, and they even mentioned that currently we're at 560 overdose deaths this year, which is more than it was last year. And there's many overdose toxicology reports that are pending. So it's very prevalent, and the overdose epidemic is very real and current. So some data from the Department of Corrections to give you guys some context about the program. About 75% of people who were in prison or jail with an opiate use disorder experienced a relapse to opioid use within 3 months of release from custody. Also, incarcerated persons who are released to the community are 10 to 40 times more likely to die of an opioid overdose than the general American population, especially within a few weeks from reentering society. And deaths from opioid overdoses have increased by 126.7% among just Wisconsin Department of Correction offenders, and 34.6 of deaths occurred while under DOC supervision. So, also, back in 2017, the Milwaukee County Heroin Opioid Cocaine Task Force was charged with investigating and making recommendations to ensure the long-term health and safety of their city and county residents by reducing fatal and non-fatal overdoses. So in 2018, the City County Heroin Opioid Cocaine Task Force did release its initial strategic plan for 2018 through 2022. And it had six areas of strategic focus. And one of those areas was criminal justice collaboration and developing programs with them. So we applied for, the Behavioral Health Division applied for a grant called BJA COSAP grant. So that's Bureau of Justice Assistant Comprehensive Opioid Stimulant and Substance Abuse Program. And we received it October 2019, and it runs through September 2022. And it was in the amount of $102 million. And some of our partners are the House of Corrections, Department of Corrections, WellPath, Community Medical Services, University of Wisconsin, and Wisconsin Community Services to provide that medication-assisted treatment behind the walls. So some eligibility to be able to participate in the program, you must be, or the participant must be at HOC or jail. They must volunteer for the program, so it's not mandatory. They must have a medical and substance use assessment, have a release date, and live in Milwaukee County. If that all is established, then the next step is being medically cleared to take Vivitrol. They would be assigned a case manager from WellPath, and they would meet with a therapist and a peer support specialist from Community Medical Services weekly, and then complete a mental health questionnaire and actively participate in treatment planning. Then they can receive up to 3 Vivitrol injections and a minimum of 2 weeks of Suboxone prior to release. And then upon release and during that time, they also get access to Milwaukee County resources, specifically the Recovery Support Coordination, which we're really excited about. And then automatically they have bus passes and Narcan that's added to their, like, their belongings to be received upon release. So some goals of this program is to provide 3 forms of FDA-approved medically assisted treatment. We currently have Vivitrol and Suboxone to offer, and then we are working very hard to get methadone to be able to be added to this as well. And then our other goal is to reduce the risk of overdose deaths by enhancing treatment and recovery engagement among the post-trial population prior to community reentry. And that's really done by implementing naloxone as an MAT for sentenced and sanctioned offenders in custody at the HOC and jail, and by supporting the transition to community-based services once these individuals are released from custody. Some benefits of this program. Trust is built while incarcerated that continues post-release, increasing confidence in recovery. Participants can see the same recovery support team, so like the peer support specialist, the mental health counselor, et cetera. The MAT is started prior to release, so the proper dosage and the stability is achieved prior to release, and that allows for like a smoother transition when a person is released. And then the program really incorporates recommendations from all agencies involved to help with that process as well. And the big overlying benefit is the risk of fatal and non-fatal overdoses is reduced post-release because of this program. Share some data. One specific comment I wanted to make is that the jail began to participate in 2021, even though the program started back in 2019. So far, as of November 2021, we've had 86 total participants and 64 have enrolled in Avatar. So here's some information about the demographics of folks that participated. Specifically, yes. Oh, I thought someone said my name. So by race, we have 37 that were white, 23 that identified as Black, 4 by other. And gender, we have 54 males and 10 that are female. And The use of heroin or opiate was 43, while other is at 21. And this data is taken from Avatar, so that means that they have an MRN and they've already they've been able to collect the data based on Avatar. Some participants, like the discrepancy in the numbers, has to do with them participating in the program, but they may not have received services yet. Thus, they're not in Avatar yet. I also wanted to share some information about our evaluation and where we're at as of today. So we currently have 11 active participants, and our evaluation team has been able to collect multiple surveys, and that includes an initial survey, a day of release survey, and then a follow-up survey at days 30, 90, and 180. And the initial survey asked questions about participants' interest in the program and factors that affected their decision to participate or not to participate. And the initial survey also asked about history of opioid use, the impact of opioid use on relationships, demographics, and then much more. But I wanted to share that as of December 31st, 2021, we have received 409 completed initial surveys. And then of those, 363 indicated an interest in the program and 46 were not. The participants also were asked to complete a day of release survey. And so that's if they did participate in the program. And so that survey asks more questions about like their likelihood of continuing services, such as medication-assisted treatment, counseling, peer support specialist, and then their perceived likelihood of success in the program and continuing on their road to recovery. And as of December 31st, we've had 58 individuals completing the day of release survey, which is really exciting. And lastly, participants that were asked to complete a follow-up survey, so that 30, 90, and 180 days, we've had 8, 2, and 4 responses that have been collected respectively. So we've had some good data collected, and we're going to be able to utilize that information and really hone in on that specific information that's collected, and that's where we're at with year 3. So year 3 just started in October of this year, of 2021, and we want to really look at outcome data, so drug use and overdoses, rearrest rates, quality of life, social and health metrics, ongoing participant and staff survey collection that's done by our UWM external evaluator. And like I mentioned earlier, we really want to get methadone available for participants, because we have heard that there are many participants that don't participate in the MAT behind the walls because they want methadone, not the other MAT that's offered, so Suboxone and Vivitrol. So we would hopefully have a higher or a larger group of folks that participate once we're able to offer all three FDA-approved MAT. And then we also want to look at sustainability. So come the end of this grant, what is going to happen with this program? Because we've had a lot of great success, a lot of people that had, in regards to the survey, 100% of the participants that filled out the day of release survey, 100% said that they would refer this program to a friend if they had an opiate use disorder. So we do see that there's a positive outlook on this program and the benefits of participating in it. And that is my presentation. So I'm happy to answer any questions if anybody would like to ask anything about MAT behind the walls.
I had one question. What's the hang up with the methadone?
So essentially, we are working with WellPath and Community Medical Services to be able to give methadone. We need to have methadone needs to be delivered daily, because the staff at HOC and jail cannot deliver it themselves. And so it can only be done by that, an external facility. So we also were denied by the state for CMS to or for CMS to be involved in having WellPath staff do it, and only CMS staff have the ability to give the methadone. So we're trying to work with the state to allow the ability to add the methadone, but it's the timeliness, it's the staff time, and there's a lot of red tape essentially from the state because of the very strict rules in delivering methadone.
The methadone rules are actually federal rules. So it's the federal methadone rules are very complex, and it's the one area where, in general, prescription of opiates to maintain an addiction is against the law, and it's the single federal carve out. So the rules are very rigid.
Thank you very much.
Does anybody else have any questions?
I put a question in the chat.
So Vicky asked,
length of time.
Yeah. So this varies. For a person to be able to participate in the program, they have to be in long enough to be able to get the MAT. So on average, I don't have the specific numbers in front of me, and I'm happy to look that up, but they need to be able to participate and get the, be able to accomplish the assessment, and then actually receive enough of the MAT and the counseling and the peer support specialist. So we don't have anybody be involved unless they minimally have at least 2 weeks before they get released, and they're able to be involved in the program much when they have much more time. But they don't get the active MAT until it's closer to the release date.
I just had a comment. This isn't directly, this isn't specific to the MAT program, but it's specific to the opiates. I know some individuals that are in pain management programs, and at Freudian Hospital now, if you are in a pain management program, you are required to accept a prescription with Narcan and have Narcan at your household in order to be in a pain management program. Like, wow, that's pretty logical. So, and I just bring that up because the Mental Health Board had put forth support for decriminalizing fentanyl test strips, and we were talking about Narcan. So just a prevention item.
Yes, Mary, thank you. I'm a huge advocate for harm reduction items, and I think fentanyl test strips and Narcan are one of the low-hanging fruits, and decriminalizing fentanyl test strips is definitely the next step before we can start handing out fentanyl test strips. But they would definitely make a difference, and data shows that it's true that people will change they'll modify their behavior based on the results of the fentanyl test strip. And that's from data from Vivint Health, but still very relevant.
Hey, any other questions for Courtney?
I do. This is Vicky. Courtney, I'm curious, do you follow them after they're released from jail, or is that a different department that would do that?
So we partnered with UWM as our evaluation team, and upon release, so they do a survey the day of their release, and then there's a 30, 90, and 180-day survey that we ask them to complete.
Okay, because that's just so important.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Cool. Appreciate it.
Cool. I'm sorry, just 1 second, Courtney, just to add, this is Janet, and Courtney's just doing a fantastic job. I just want to add, so when Courtney had talked about in the data about the avatar, the expectation, quite honestly, is that once they are released, they are actually enrolled in CAR services. And so they do continue to receive recovery support coordination, peer support services, treatment. They may access bridge housing or other services. They may eventually enroll in CCS as well. So along with the follow-up evaluation, they're absolutely enrolled in CAR services as well.
Thank you, Janet.
Sure, Courtney.
Anything else? And feel free to reach out to me if you have any questions or like to learn more about the program. I'm happy to share. Thanks, everyone, for your time.
Thank you, Courtney. Excellent job.
item number 3.